Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Caroline Crampton, standing in for your regular host Helen Lewis, and on this week's podcast, George Eaton and Lucy Fisher discuss the alternate fortunes of Labour and the Lib Dems. NS editor Jason Cowley and Ian Steadman discuss the World Cup in Brazil and whether this could be the last authentic tournament. Philip Maughan talks to the novelist Emma McBride, winner of the 2014 Bailey's Prize, and Yo Zushi interviews musician Jerry David DeSica. I'm here with George Eaton and Lucy Fisher, and we're going to discuss two things we've got in the magazine this week that seem to suggest quite interesting shifts in two different parties. We're going to kick off with Labour. Now, Marcus Roberts, who I understand used to work for Ed Miliband, has written a very interesting piece in the magazine this week about Labour's fortunes. George, what does he say?
Yes, so Marcus, who is Deputy General Secretary of the Fabian Society and served as Field Director of Miliband's leadership campaign, has written quite a bold piece saying that based on the number crunching he does, he thinks Labour's on course to lose at the moment. The Conservatives will be the largest party and that they badly need a change of strategy to avoid that outcome. In particular, he thinks that they need to do more to appeal to what he calls blue collar voters. So working class voters who perhaps used to vote Labour, stopped in 2005, 2010, and who are now being picked up by UKIP. He thinks for too long, Labour's been focused on holding on to those who voted for it in 2010 and attracting voters from the Lib Dems and holding on to them. And actually what we're seeing now in some of the marginal seats that Labour has to win, simply to be the largest party, let alone to win a majority, UKIP is eating into its votes. And the concern is that once you get to the general election, and history suggests that there will be a swing back to the Tories, might not be huge, but there will be some swing back. Then Labour loses those seats and you're left in a position where David Cameron can hope to survive as Prime Minister, as leader of the largest party.
And we should be clear that we're talking about largest parties here. We're not in the realm of talking about anyone getting enough of a majority to form a government.
No, and Marcus is actually on the optimistic end of the Labour spectrum in the sense that he believes if they make the necessary changes that they can win a majority. And actually this is a historic opportunity for Labour, because of the collapse of the Lib Dem vote and because of the living standards crisis. There is space for a radical, bold centre-left offer that could win majority support in a way that people didn't believe there was under New Labour, where Labour is obsessed with occupying the centre ground, which in practice meant a position not far to the left of a sort of moderate conservative position.
And in the wake of the European elections particularly, Lucy, there was a lot of discussion amongst various Labour shadow cabinet ministers and broader outside in the party about whether Labour needs to talk more about immigration as a way of producing this shift and getting more of these blue-collar voters back to them. Do you think that they do need to talk about it more, less, more detail, less detail? What's your view?
I actually think it's pointing slightly in the wrong direction to get too centred on the immigration debate. When I went recently to Newark and were talking to people who were traditional, these blue-collar working-class voters who had shifted from Labour to UKIP, immigration did come up, but there was much more sense that Labour, the party hierarchy in Parliament, didn't reflect them. And I think, in a sense, it's more of an image problem, because they are touting some fairly radical policies, I think. You know, they're going for market intervention, energy price freezes, they're promising 200,000 affordable homes. You know, these are policies that should appeal to these blue-collar voters. But in fact, we've lost the authenticity in Labour. the shadow cabinet ministers you're talking about, they don't reflect those voters as perhaps they did under New Labour. You know, we had Alan Johnson, David Blunkett, John Prescott, Jack Straw, genuine working class men themselves. So I think it's an image problem personified mainly by or chiefly by Ed Miliband.
And that's, as you say, that's a kind of personnel problem even at the top of the party. That's not necessarily something that's fixable in the next year before the general election,
no,
is
it?
So I suppose it's for them, it's about making the best of a bad job and trying to turn their sort of rhetoric and their, well, I suppose Marcus is a field campaign guy, you know, he knows about getting the vote out and, you know, turning people's impressions of things. So he's talking about the kind of technical nudge shift stuff that you see on polling data. But what do you reckon, George? Do we need a kind of big sweeping gesture from Labour to acknowledge this kind of thing?
No, I don't think big sweeping gestures work, particularly if they're politically motivated or transparently so. What I think you do need is to weave the policies that you do have, and there are a lot and there are more coming, into a national story that resonates with people in the same way that Nigel Farage's narrative of loss and abandonment and betrayal does. And it has to be an optimistic offer. One of the good points that John Cruddas, the head of the policy review, makes is that Labour always wins big when it has a national story, when it has an optimistic message. In 1945, it's national renewal after the war. In 1966, Harold Wilson and the White Heat of Technology. 1997, New Labour, things can only get better. Miliband needs to find a way to create a sense of a patriotic mission to rebuild Britain after austerity. And that is certainly what John Cruddas and his allies in the party want to see. They've got a lot of policy coming out now, and the next few months will be the test of whether they can achieve that.
It's that phrase, isn't it? It's requiring that phrase that you can put into every sentence between now and next May to explain what it is your story is. It's something that strikes me, actually, is the cost of living crisis has obviously been a big discussion for Labour. But every single time a Labour MP brings it up, it sounds negative. Whereas it should sound, there is a cost of living crisis and we're going to improve it, we're going to get rid of it. But it just sounds relentlessly negative. Lucy?
I completely agree with you. And I think one problem now that's only going to get worse for Labour is the fact that with the economy going from strength to strength, the Tories really have the positive, optimistic narrative in their favour. As Cameron said yesterday at Prime Minister's Questions, Ed Miliband, you are allergic to good news, which of course is ridiculous in a sense. But he does bring out the point that any good news, the economy, like unemployment coming down to 6.6%, is difficult for Labour to argue against or show how they would make it better.
To fit it into their story, isn't it?
Yeah.
And speaking of bad news, a party that's had a lot of that over the last few years is the Lib Dems. Now, in your column this week, George, you've posited that it might not be quite so bad for the Lib Dems as it appears.
Yes, well, they are at a record low today, in fact, 6% in YouGov, which is the lowest figure they've had since that polling company was founded in 2001. And the piece is saying there is a good chance that we are living in an era of hung parliaments, that the next parliament there will be no majority party. And so the hope for the Lib Dems is that they can be the coalition partner to the Tories or Labour. And have influence that way. But the piece is really like, must they always suffer as a result? So when David Cameron visited Angela Merkel shortly before the 2010 general election, knowing that he was unlikely to win a majority, he said to her, what's it like to lead a coalition government? And she said, how the little party always gets smashed. How prescient was that? So I think the one key change that the Lib Dems could make looking forward to thrive in coalition is to take ownership of whole departments. So when Clegg and the others entered coalition, they didn't take on whole departments that they could then be identified with and be identified with the policy achievements that came from those. They spread themselves across Whitehall. I don't think that approach has worked because it's made it harder for them to define their identity. It's meant that the junior ministers they have looked like helpless hostages of their conservative superiors. So a sensible approach, and there are some in the party who agree with this. I mean, Tim Farron has said it would be wise for them to look at this. Would be saying a Lib Dem Labour coalition, the Lib Dems take housing. We're going to take credit for a big house building programme. Or they take the Home Office and say, we are going to act as the guardians of civil liberties against those Labour authoritarians. That resonates with their activists, and it helps to maintain their identity in the eyes of the public.
Because in areas where Lib Dem ministers have managed to own an issue, to use a rather unpleasant phrase, they have had some cut through. I'm thinking of Lynn Featherston, particularly in her work on FGM and body image and so on. She is identified with what has been a positive bit of legislation, some good rechanneling of funding there. So I suppose to maximise that at a higher ministerial level is what you're suggesting, right?
Yeah.
What do you reckon, Lucy? Where are the areas the Lib Dems could take ownership?
Well, I really agree with you that Lynn Featherston's done a great job and been recognised for that. And I think George's suggestions certainly would be the best way forward for the Lib Dems. But the big issue I would see facing them and trying to achieve that is, you know, which department would the senior partner in any coalition concede? Mm. And I don't think they're going to give up any of the big, certainly none of the big offices of state, such as the Home Office, Foreign Office, or the Treasury. So then any achievements that could be made would be relatively minor in comparison to the rest of government that would be in the hands solely, by the sounds of it, of the senior partner.
Mm. Well, I think that's what you have to bargain hard. I think Clegg, it would have been impossible for the Conservatives to have a majority without the Lib Dems. In Germany, Joschka Fischer, the leader of the Greens, was the foreign secretary. I think Clegg cut a very bad deal in 2010. And yes, he became deputy prime minister, and he thought that was wise because he could range across all departments, keep an eye on everything that was going on. In fact, he just found himself exhausted and overworked because he didn't have the forces at his disposal that the prime minister does. And so he's sort of hurriedly taking on an army of special advisers in an attempt to catch up. I think if Labour needed the Lib Dems to get over the line and it was, look, give us the Home Office or we're not doing this, they have to bargain harder. And I think everyone says Labour were underprepared, but in some ways the Lib Dems were too. And this was sort of first for them. And I think they were slightly shell-shocked because you'd had Clegg Mania and they ended up losing seats. Next time, Clegg's already appointed his negotiating team. They've got much more time to prepare, much more time to think about it. We won't be in a state of economic emergency or perceived economic emergency. So there won't be, I hope, the frenzy to form a government within a week. So I actually think if we do take a more patient approach, like most European countries do, sometimes you don't have governments for 6 months, then you actually get better outcomes for 5 years.
Well, so coalition negotiations to look forward to. Thanks very much, Lucy and George. Cowley, editor of The New Statesman, and Ian Steadman, our science writer on The New Statesman website, are here to talk about the World Cup, which kicks off today and is also the cover story in this week's magazine. Jason, you wrote about the World Cup and you said this could be the last World Cup. What did you mean by that?
I was having a little bit of fun by saying it's the last World Cup, but what I meant is it the last authentic World Cup?
Right.
I had the good fortune in 2006, when I was working on The Observer on the Sunday paper, to cover the World Cup in Germany. So I went from the beginning of the tournament to the end, and it was a wonderful experience to be inside that country, which at the very beginning of the tournament was very anxious, sense of nervous self-scrutiny. Germany had hosted big sporting events before. A World Cup in 1974, when the country was divided between the communist East and the West, and also the 1972 Olympics, which were an absolute disaster. They had a terrorist attack by Palestinians on the Israelis, in the Israeli athletes in the village. 11 were kidnapped and murdered, so that was an absolute disaster. And before that, in 1936, when they also hosted the Olympics, it was scarred by Hitler and grotesque Nazi propaganda. So there was great nervousness inside Germany. Germans, very understandably, are anxious about any displays, ostentatious displays of patriotism So when I arrived in the country, no one was flying the German flag, for example. And indeed, that summer when I left England, you could see the flag of St. George everywhere. So there was a great sense of optimism about the English team then. But during the tournament, the 5 weeks of the tournament, the whole mood in the country changed. And by the end of it, you saw the flag everywhere, the German flag everywhere. But it was relaxed patriotism of a kind that was wonderful. And Merkel was amazed by the transformation that took place in Germany. And the world looked at the new Germany, and the world very much liked what it saw.
Mm. So there was a kind of authenticity of the sporting event coming together with its host nation and so on. And now fast forward to 2014, the World Cup's taking place in Brazil. There have been controversy for over a year now with protests, stadium contracts, corruption allegations, allegations about corruption inside the sports governing body, FIFA, as well as in the country itself. Ian, is your sense that the World Cup is no longer as Jason's just described?
Yeah, there's this, I mean, I often hear people talk about how the World Cup is no longer as the best football in the world. And that's kind of been a sense for the past, I don't know, maybe since 1998 or 2002, that there's been a real divide as the club side of the game has become even more professional, even more scientific. Training methods have become even better. Teams play together so often, there's this language that players learn to speak on the pitch, and then they get dragged apart and put in their national sides and play a couple of friendlies, and it's not the same spirit or atmosphere. But there is, I guess this is kind of similar to the Olympics, where there's this sort of platonic ideal of it being a sporting event that brings people together, and it's this wonderful thing, and the reality of it, which is a very corporatized, commercialized way for expensive contracts to be handed out to people and corruption allegations. Mm. And it's become not so much about the sport, but just about making money, which people don't want to see.
Well, this is it, isn't it? That even if you are wildly excited about the sport, most of the news in the run-up to the World Cup has been about the vast amounts of money that are mostly going to be leaving Brazil, that are not going to be staying in the host nation. And, you know, Brazil's built stadiums in places where there aren't professional teams to use them and all this kind of thing. Jason, do you think it's actually something a country would seek now to host the World Cup?
Yeah, I still think you can see why Brazil would want to host the World Cup. Football, in many ways, is a supreme instrument of soft power in the world. It's the global game. It's the global language in many ways. And Brazil is a great football country. I mean, it's won the World Cup 5 times. And it's right that the tournament is there. But at the same time, as Ian says, there's huge problems inside the country. Massive unrest. You've had protests, strikes, marches against the World Cup, but also against government incompetence, corruption and indifference. At the same time, this particular tournament is shadowed once again by FIFA corruption. Some excellent allegations in the Sunday Times about how the decision to host, the decision to give the World Cup to Qatar in particular in 2022 looks as if it was bought. No surprise there. I mean, one knows that FIFA at best is opaque, at worst is corrupt. And indeed, the decision also to give it to Putin's Russia in 2018 looks deeply murky as well. So this is the backdrop to this tournament. Every World Cup becomes that much more expensive. I mean, the Brazilians have spent in excess of $10 billion. Still, the stadiums aren't ready. Massive infrastructure projects haven't been completed in time. And this is a country, nearly 200 million people, 50 million of whom live in abject poverty.
Mm. The viral image of this World Cup so far is a piece of graffiti where the artist has drawn a crying, starving child sitting at a table with a football on his plate. And that's become the image that sums up all the protests and the riots and the fury about it. I don't know where it goes from here. It's kind of after the IOC kind of reformed itself after all the corruption allegations. It was Salt Lake City?
The International Olympic Committee?
Yeah. There were a lot of corruption, which kind of feels like that was a very similar thing that happened there. That was a very opaque organisation. I mean, it's still not perfect, but it did reform itself slightly after what felt like kind of the last straw. And it feels like there is kind of this head of steam building towards maybe Blatter resigning or
Sepp
something.
Blatter, president of FIFA, and indeed president's a good word for him, because FIFA operates almost like a kind of country or a state, has that kind of power. And the World Cup for FIFA is this huge engine of, well-oiled engine of cash generation. And you can see why some of the members, or many of the members of FIFA, most of which are from the developing world, would want Blatter to remain in power. I mean, that's his power base. It's not the big European countries. And he's generating, or his tournament is generating, huge revenues. Where I think, for me, this is why I'm calling it the last World Cup, because FIFA at present is deeply odious, and it has the partners, i.e. Putin's Russia, and the Gulf autocrats of Qatar that it deserves, in my opinion. And why should we participate? But where reform could come, and you hinted at it, is the power of the clubs, particularly the big European clubs. And Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, the chairman of Bayern Munich in particular, has spoken out already against.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
FIFA and Blatter. And if reform is to come, it could be forced by the clubs, by Bayern, Juventus, Milan, Barca, Real Madrid, Manchester United, plus the corporate sponsors. Five of the six major sponsors of this tournament, led by Sony, have spoken out about the corruption allegations, and they're very concerned. So if there's change, I don't think it will come from inside FIFA, but it might come from external pressure.
This reminds me of the Donald Sterling thing in America, which he owned the LA Lakers. Oh, God, I can't remember. I don't know much about American
sports.
Essentially, he owned an LA big sports, big basketball franchise. He made some very racist remarks, and it became a huge story in America. And the thing with sort of the basketball authorities over there is that, I mean, they weren't going to do anything. They fined him a pittance for it. But when the corporate sponsors started pulling out from sponsoring the team, he was forced to sell the team. And I wonder if that's really the most promising route for reform.
I think that's where the pressure could come. But we ought not to be too gloomy at the same time. The World Cup starts today in Brazil. Brazil play Croatia this evening. We love football.
Ian
and I love football.
It's like Christmas.
That was going to be my final question, is given all of that that we've just discussed, can you still look forward to and enjoy the football you're about to watch?
I can, Caroline, because I'm a football fan, and fandom's irrational. It's sort of, it's about emotions and commitment you make to a club and country in boyhood or girlhood, which you can never break free from if indeed you are a true fan. So I think just watching football, great football, I hope, every night, England are playing against Italy on Saturday, is a source of optimism, and for many people in the world, a source of joy and potential unity. So one is looking forward to the football, what happens on the pitch itself. One is alarmed by what's happening off the pitch.
Thanks very much, Jason and Liam.
In November 2013, a relatively unknown novelist named Emma McBride won the inaugural Goldsmiths Prize for her debut novel, A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing. At the end of the ceremony, she thanked her publisher, the small Norwich-based press, Gallybeggar Press, and she said that small presses would be the saviour of us all because they were publishing far more experimental works than any of the major publishers. I caught up with her earlier this week after it was announced that she had won the 2014 Bailey's Prize for Fiction, to ask her whether this was still the case.
I wrote the book in 6 months, in 2004-2005, and started to send it out straight away, and immediately met with a wall of incredibly admiring rejection letters, most of which said that, you know, while they thought the style was very interesting, subject matter was, you know, well handled, and, you know, they thought it was a great book, they couldn't see any particular marketing niche for it, and so with regret would have to decline, which was pretty soul-destroying. And that went on, really, for about 5 years, and then I put it in the drawer and decided to get on with my second book, and really gave up hope that it would be published first. and I hope maybe it will be published on the back of the second one. And then my husband and I moved to Norwich. And one day he was in the bookshop, in the book hive in the centre of Norwich, chatting to Henry Late behind the counter, who asked what his wife did, and he told him the whole sorry tale. And Henry said, well, that's, you know, very interesting, because some friends and I are thinking of setting up a press. Do you think she'd let us read it? And so I did, and he really loved it, and said, you know, this is a great book, and we'd love to publish it. But we have no money and we're just about to publish our first book and we're not really sure what we're doing. And can we come back to you when we're a bit more sorted out? And I said, fine, and was quite sure I would never hear from them again. Mm. And but a year later, they came back and said, OK, we're ready. Still have no money, but we're very enthusiastic. Mm. Will you trust us with the book? And I said I would. And so they published it and it came out just under a year ago.
And I have that very edition, the black cover, which, you know,
Gallipager cover.
Saving that one for eBay. and it's quite astonishing, really, the distance between, you know, writing a book in 6 months and then having a sort of 9-year publishing kind of farrago, getting it out. When you return to the book after all that time, you didn't have any doubts. You didn't think, this is me 10 years ago. You know what I mean? How did you feel when you went back to it?
Well, you know, the first time I read it, it had been so long that I accidentally read the wrong draft and read the first draft and got to the end of it and thought, oh my God, this is a mess. And no one wanted to publish it. And what will I do? And then luckily realized that it was the wrong draft and read the right draft. And it was, you know, it was very strange because there was a lot of it that I had completely forgotten. And so to work on it again, to go through it, you know, for an edit was a really strange experience because I'd obviously been writing a lot in the intervening years and I'd learned a lot, as you do when, you know, the more you write, the more you understand about the process. And it was difficult to decide which part of my writer self should be in control of that edit. Should I, you know, continue or try to recreate the spirit of the original, or should I allow the things that I had learned to maybe creep in and inform how I did this final edit? And in the end, it was kind of a mix of the both. And there are still some things in that book which I feel are unresolved, and I couldn't solve them then, and I couldn't solve them later, and so I just had to leave them be. But quite like, I think that's part of the beauty of it, is there's a rawness to it and an immediacy to it that maybe if I had managed to solve every problem, it would have polished the life out of it.
I remember we were talking about this down at Goldsmiths. You talked about Finnegan's Wake as kind of being the end of modernism, arguably the end of literature. I mean, how can you take it any further than Finnegan's Wake? And that your project, I remember, was to step back and maybe forge another path, you know, and to have gone on, you know, on this path to get the kind of recognition that a prize like the Bailey's Prize will bring. I mean, what's your sort of hope for this? Clearly, people are receptive to the idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, and I've said this a number of times recently, I think, you know, publishers have been hugely underestimating their readers. And I think, you know, there's plenty of room left in modernism for exploration. And I think there is an enthusiasm there for writing that takes risks and that asks the reader to make an effort, that asks something and offers something in return for that effort. And, you know, very, very hearteningly, the other night at the Bailey's Prize, there was, you know, a number of people in publishing who said that they felt it was quite exciting that this book had won because they felt they could go back and dig around in the drawer for the books that they had wanted to publish that they had been told they couldn't.
Mm. Do you ever think of yourself in a position of exile, kind of comparable to Joyce's? Because notably, I mean, you live, you know, in Norwich. Joyce was very, very well known for keeping his distance, shall we say.
Yeah.
And, you know, so much of what is in the book, and this has been one of the notable sort of factors of reading about My Girl Is a Half-On Thing, is that people don't know how to deal with the subject matter, because to say, you know, that there's sort of child abuse and Catholicism and all of these things is almost to go, yeah, we got an Irish novel here. Is there kind of a sort of comparable process of growing up and moving out, you know, going on in this book in the same way as in a portrait?
Well, you know, I think I would have found it very hard to write this book if I had been living in Ireland at the time. And it was always very important to me to try and set the book apart from that social realism tradition of, you know, or Irish miserabilism at large, you know, that I really wanted to avoid. And it was important to me to try and set the book, you know, although it is grounded very much in Ireland and Irish culture, and many of the themes are classic, you know, infamously so, themes of Irish life and Irish literature, that, you know, that the book would be more outward facing, would be a European novel rather than an Irish realist novel.
Did the voice just sort of, because the style is so, you know, unique, it's so startling, it's so original when you first sort of encounter it, did it come out fully formed, or did you gestate this for years before you actually put sort of pen to paper?
No, a lot of it was instinct, but I certainly wrote my way into it. You know, I started off with a different idea for the book and started, you know, I knew it wasn't going to be written in straightforward language, and I knew that that language was certainly going to be part of my shtick. Hmm. And so I, you know, I was just kind of writing, bashing away with this other idea that wasn't coming to anything. And then one day I just came across the opening of A Girl Is a Half Home Thing, and I knew at that point this would be something different to what I had been working towards, and that I just had to follow it. And then, you know, the story grew from that point on, because it was, you know, it was completely different to what I'd had in mind. And then the language, I just built the language around the story, so it was there to support the story at all times.
You trained as an actor, didn't you? Did that sort of play any, because voice is so, you know, so essential, and so you will have spent time thinking about the way that you project and so on. Do you think that had an influence?
Yeah, I think it had a huge influence. I had, you know, a method school training, which was all about, you know, getting down into the roots of the character and inside of them, and making that internal life, you know, visible on stage. And I think a lot of that, of the style of A Girl, is about expressing those ideas through language rather than through physicalization. You know, just drawing in all these disparate experiences and, you know, thought and emotion and secondary thought and gut reaction and physical sensation, all of these things happening all at once. That's, you know, that came from that acting background and that approach to creating a character.
And finally, you mentioned earlier a second book, which you'd already started before all of this happened. Did you have to sort of put that away, and have you picked it up again, and what can we expect next?
Well, yes, I mean, it's about 5 years of work on it now, and I thought it would be finished this year, but it's not going to be finished this year. It will probably be finished next year, though, and I'm starting to get a bit homesick for it. I'm looking forward to getting back to writing it again now, once the fuss has died down a bit. And yeah, I wouldn't say more of the same, but language is still a preoccupation.
Fascinating. Well, I can't wait to see it. Thanks very much for joining us, Emma.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Yozushi, and I'm talking to Jerry David DeChica of the Black Swans. Jerry's just released a solo album, his first, called Understanding Land. And it's very much a collaborative work which features people like Will Oldham, Kelly Deal of the Breeders, and the Muscle Shoals organist, Spooner Oldham. Now, was this an album where collaboration was an important part of the process, or did it just turn out this way?
Well, I think whenever you're asking other people to add their voices to something that you're creating, collaboration becomes you know, like the focus of how successful that it's actually going to be. in making a solo record, it did give me the opportunity to collaborate in a way that I hadn't heard of my songs before with the Black Swans. All those records are documents, really, of close friends and our time together. So they become little musical time capsules of our time together. With Understanding Land is a solo record, you know, I asked people I knew and admired to add their voice on top of mine. So their instrument became a response to what was already recorded. So the collaborative process took a different shape this time. And, you know, and as a songwriter and a record maker and a person, you know, I feel really lucky now to have been able to experience both in my music because, you know, they're both beautiful ways to create.
One of your songs, 29th of June, makes an apocalyptic narrative out of the storms that happened in 2012 that tore through the Midwest, eventually killing 22 people and passing through Ohio, where you were based at the time. And you have lyrics like, "The sky tore down the town." And that reminded me of blues lyrics with Charlie Patton or later, you know, Randy Newman singing about the 1927 Louisiana flood. How much is this idea of utter destruction and apocalypse a part of the American imagination?
You know, that song in particular, it's very much musically, at least in my acoustic guitar part, and lyrically, you know, modeled after the doom and gloom metaphors you might find in country blues. So Charlie Patton's a really good reference point. It's like you're reporting on the weather, but you're really talking about your own troubled mind. I suppose that's American in some ways. You know, you can still drive down the highway, and if you pick the right highway on a right day, you don't see anyone, or at least another person, for hours, unless it's a hitchhiker or a farmer or something like that. So, you know, maybe that it's a sense of vulnerability, or maybe it's this idea that, you know, we just don't have as much history in this country, so there's not a sense that that things will last, or maybe it's that things are more fleeting than they actually are.
I've been talking to Jerry David DeChica, whose first solo album, Understanding Land, is out now. For more information about what Jerry's up to, go to jerrydaviddechica.com. And Jerry is going to play us a song, and I'll leave you with that. Thanks.
This song's one from Understanding Land. It's called Colors in the Sky. It's a song kind of about how, you know, we go through life and there's so many hard things to make it tough for us to keep going on. But it's noticing the small things in life that helps us kind of carry on and carry through.
All I do is wait for rainbows, this consolation to the rain. Maybe God is just a scarecrow, some days a farmer in a field of pain. And in the din I hear the wind blow, as the gristmill grinds the grain. And I've got sorrows on my table, there's no bread on my neighbor's plate. Still I see colors in the sky, I see colors in the sky, I see colors in the sky, I don't know why. I see colors in the sky. Thank you. if the spectrum stopped appearing and the world remained in gray, would our necks grow tight from staring into a sky of soot and clay? And as the darkness does surround us in the horrors of our days, guess I just can't stop believing in a purple orange green haze. Still I see colors in the sky, I see colors in the sky, I see colors in the sky, I don't know why. I see colors in the sky, I see colors in the sky, I see colors.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.